Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Serial Killer Podcast, the podcast dedicated to serial killers, who they were, what they did, and how, episode 220. I am your humble host, Thomas Rosland Weiberg Thun, and tonight we continue this two-part feature covering the case of the slaying brothers Briley. Last episode ended with middle brother James shooting a police officer during a chase. Tonight, we continue down their path of death and destruction towards their final demise. Enjoy. This episode, like all other sagas told by me, would not be possible without my loyal Patreonies. They are Lisbeth, Russell, Lisa, Kathy, James, Cody, Kylie, Robert, Val, Marilyn, Craig, Emily, the Duggletons, Jonathan, Jennifer, Lunavar, Roy, Cheryl, Richard, Brad, Laurie, Manuel, Haley, James, Jeff, Evulin, Meg, Crystal, and Ricky. You are truly the backbone of the Serial Killer Podcast, and without you, there would be no show. Thank you.
I am forever grateful for my elite TSK Producers Club. And I want to show you that your patronage is not given in vain. All TSK episodes will be available 100% ad-free to my TSK Producers Club on patreon.com/theserialkillerpodcast. No generic ads, no ad reads, no jingles. I promise. And of course, if you wish to donate $15 a month, that's only $7.50 per episode. You are more than welcome to join the ranks of the TSK Producers Club, too. So don't miss out and join now.
Only two souls managed to escape the deadly clutches of the Briley brothers, this time Linwood and Anthony, to tell their tale. William and Virginia Boucher. Now both have passed on, their stories echoing in the grave. Unless the shadows of the past decide to part and reveal hitherto unknown survivors or witnesses, the blood-curdling events that transpired on the night of the 12th of March 1979 stand as the gruesome overture to a seven-month symphony of horror. The modus operandi of these ruthless killers was as cold as it was random. Linwood, the elder of the two, sauntered up to the quaint, tightly packed home of the Bushers. Nestled in the heart of Lafayette Avenue, and rapped his knuckles against the front door in a parody of normalcy. William Boucher, in a later account, revealed his initial assumption that it was the paperboy come to collect his due, which rendered him unguarded enough to open the door. As the portal swung open, he found himself staring not at the familiar face of the paperboy, but at the strange and unsettling countenance of a complete unknown. In the flickering porch light, the stranger's face was a mask of innocence. He spun a tale of automotive misfortune, asking if Boucher would be so gracious to allow him to call AAA for aid. Trusting, or perhaps merely unsuspecting, Boucher agreed to lend a hand and extended his own for the stranger's club card. In a startling blur of motion, the pretense shattered. Linwood lunged forward, seizing Boucher with wild eyes and the violent desperation of a cornered animal. Across the room, Virginia's blood ran cold as she saw the brutal tableau. Her dear husband, a gun pressed against his temple, a knife's edge gleaming at his throat. Her heart pounded in her ears as Linwood delivered his chilling warning. An outcry would cost her husband an ear. With a quick jerk of his head, Linwood signaled his accomplice. The front door creaked open once more, and in slithered the younger Briley, Anthony, his presence a malevolent echo of his brother's. One of the brothers kept them under the cold gaze of his gun, a threatening sentinel against any thought of resistance. The couple were taken to separate rooms and shoved face down to the floor, hands roped behind their backs. The marauders tore through the house like a pack of ravenous wolves, their greed insatiable. They seized every treasure they could lay their greedy hands on. Precious trinkets of jewelry, a CB radio, a .32-caliber handgun that bore the weight of its lethal potential. They even took a police scanner, an eerie echo of their previous escape from the law's clutches in the chill of October. The couple's twin televisions were not spared, and neither was anything else of value. In their malicious intent to mute the two eyewitnesses to their heinous act, they showered the rooms with lighter fluid, drenching the furniture, some clothing hidden under a table, and even William Boucher himself in the volatile liquid. With the cold confidence of those accustomed to evil, the brothers strode out, their ill-gotten gains loaded into their car. One of them took the liberty of stealing the Boucher's vehicle, a symbol of their audacity, later discovered abandoned. The fire, birthed by their malevolence, roared to life, and the piercing shriek of the smoke alarm echoed ominously through the doomed house. But amidst the chaos, a glimmer of hope. William Boucher slipped out a hand from his bonds, ran to the kitchen for a knife, and freed Virginia. Had William's wrists been more soundly secured, he and his wife would have suffered an agonizing death being burned alive. A tongue of flame did catch hold of William's clothing, but he managed to quickly put it out. March proved an active month for the Briley gang, resulting in William and Virginia Boucher's near-death experience, the murder of Michael McDuffie, and the dates of 12 and 21
assuming an airy mirror image aspect. There is also a very obscure report from the 31st of March 1979, reporting that Linwood Briley shot a 28-year-old man, Edric Alvin Clark, in his home during a drug-related argument. Duncan Meekins purportedly was an accomplice. This account is mentioned only in a single newspaper article listing the murders. Also from this article is report of yet another killing, that of 32-year-old Thomas Saunters, this time with Meekins pulling the trigger in the middle of a scuffle, also involving James and Linwood Briley. Michael W. McDuffie, who lived in a Richmond suburb, probably was enjoying some downtime on the 21st of March 1979 from his stressful job servicing vending machines for Canteen of Virginia, Inc. Long before the term home invasion was coined, McDuffie was introduced to the concept when the uninvited Brileys assaulted and shot him, robbed the house, and dumped McDuffie's body into his car. On the 9th of April, 1979, the Brileys and Duncan Meekins were cruising around North Richmond when they noticed 76-year-old Mary Gowan walking out of her daughter's residence where she'd been babysitting. The gang followed Mary all the way across town to her home, a three-story red brick complex in an upscale neighborhood. Mary parked in the street, climbed out of her car, and stepped along the sidewalk toward her corner apartment. She must have been worn out from babysitting and did not notice the four young men moving behind her. They rushed forward and shoved Mary into a stairwell. One of them beat her and she fell. Each gang member raped her. She was shot in the head at close range, robbed, and left to die. Mary somehow managed to crawl up two flights of stairs in a desperate attempt to call for help. Then she went into a coma, remained in a coma for 90 days, died on the 2nd of July, and was buried on the 4th of July. That same swelteringly hot Independence Day, 1979, the Briley gang spotted a lone figure lingering near the shiny chrome-finished automobile of their eldest, Linwood. The figure was a youth, a mere 17 summers to his name, who went by the name of Christopher Phillips. His furtive glances and uneasy posture hinted at his intentions, perhaps to claim the vehicle. The gang, like a pack of wolves sensing weakness, closed in on Phillips, their faces hard and unyielding as stone. The air between them crackled with tension, a silent interrogation unfolding in the stifling summer heat. Not a question was voiced, or at least none that history has chosen to remember. The Brileys rushed Phillips, and a struggle ensued. Quickly the stranger was shoved down and manhandled into a conveniently empty backyard. Phillips cried out for help, which angered the gang, especially Linwood. Uncharacteristically, the eldest Briley did not draw a firearm and shoot Phillips. Instead, a cinder block was found and dropped onto the young man's head, crushing it so that brain matter poured out beneath the concrete. Death would have been mercifully quick. Mayo Island, less than half a mile long, is currently a privately owned property holding a parking lot and a recycling center. In September 1979, an abandoned paper mill stood there, unsecured and easily accessed by taking the Mayo Bridge, US Highway 360, across the James River. The rusting ruin, like the others scattered throughout America, was exactly the sort of structure that attracts those looking for privacy and or adventure. Anything could happen there, and no one was the wiser. The Log Cabin was a popular South Richmond nightclub and restaurant. Johnny G. Gallagher, well-known country music DJ for WXGI, spent weekends playing bass guitar with local bands. On one of those unusually fun nights, the 14th of September, the band stopped for a break. Gallagher was not a smoker, and on that night stepped outside behind the establishment for a few minutes of fresh air and quiet. Earlier that evening, the Briley brothers and Duncan Meekins decided they wanted to venture into the Richmond night and find someone to rob. Their months of predatory experience infused the gang with a sense of invulnerability, and, as noted by investigators, robbery had become incidental to the crime spree, an excuse to cover for the real thrill of murdering vulnerable people unlikely to be much of a threat. Gathering a sawed-off shotgun and high-caliber rifle, the Brileys and Meekins climbed into Linwood's purple Chevy Nova and drove toward South Richmond. On Jefferson Davis Highway, not far from the James River, they noticed the log cabin, slowed, and parked nearby. Concealing themselves in bushes and rough growth behind the nightclub, the gang waited for an appropriate, intoxicated victim to emerge from the rear door. The door opened, and John Gallagher stepped into the darkness. Linwood burst from hiding and raised his rifle, forced Gallagher onto the ground, and took his wallet and car keys. Linwood tossed the stolen keys to Meekins and ordered the teen to locate Gallagher's Lincoln Continental, get inside, and drive it up to the scene. Linwood got his victim standing and, with Meekins' help, shoved him into the Lincoln's trunk and closed it. The two climbed into the front seat and drove away south from the log cabin. James and Anthony Briley followed in their brother's vehicle. Linwood and Meekins took U.S. Highway 360 to the 14th Street Bridge, where it crosses the James River, and turned onto the property then dominated by the looming paper mill. The others nosed in behind them. The Lincoln's trunk was opened, and Gallagher made to climb out. He fell, and as he struggled to his feet, Linwood took the opportunity to shoot him point-blank in the head, his brain spraying out behind him in a fine rust-colored mist. Death would have been instantaneous, and his body immediately slumped lifeless to the ground. Back at the log cabin, Johnny G's fellow musicians and friends wondered why he had yet to return from his break and went out to look for him. This behavior, they agreed, was out of character for Johnny G from Tennessee, wholly reliable and consistent in his words and actions. Many people loved the gentleman. His musicianship and radio show and the selfless habit he had of caring for others, being helping with homework, trimming a Christmas tree, or simply bringing more light into hanging out and watching Sunday afternoon football on TV. The Briley gang dragged Gallagher to the river and rolled him into the black churning waters. Fewer than 20 minutes had gone by since the initial attack. The group got into Gallagher's Lincoln, headed back into Richmond, and drove aimlessly until the gas gauge neared empty. Back on Mayo Island, they stripped the car of items deemed valuable and there abandoned it. On Saturday, the 15th of September, Gallagher's car was found. Detective Jim Gaudet suspected that the DJ would be found in the trunk and forced it open. By this time, investigators were close to certain that Gallagher had gone missing due to some violent crime, yet had no evidence backing this. Processing the Lincoln, the team discovered a fingerprint behind one door panel, probably left during the stripping and burglary, which netted the criminals $6 in cash, a CB radio, antenna, and very little else. The interior panel had been pried open in a reckless exploration for stereo speakers. After a 3-day search, Gallagher still had yet to be found. Several days later, though, Some men fishing discovered the body, which likely had been caught in submerged tree branches and river debris.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Another example of the Briley gang's random brutality is their treatment of 62-year-old nurse Mary Wilfong. On the 30th of September 1979, 2 weeks after the John Gallagher abduction and murder, the gang decided to follow Wilfong to her small Henrico County home in suburban Richmond. Details on this case are scant, but it is known that the devoted nurse was accosted as she strolled along the sidewalk leading to her front door. Linwood carried a baseball bat and used it to beat the woman to death. Entering the residence, the gang scoured it for valuables, as was done with Mary Gowan. Excepting rape, Mary Wilfong was left to die at the entrance of her home. Her death would have been a drawn-out and painful one, slowly bleeding to death internally and externally from the savage beating. During the first week of October 1979, neighbors concerned about the well-being of two elderly Fifth Avenue residents, 79-year-old Blanche Page and her boarder, Charles Garner, 59, telephoned Richmond police for a safety check. Page was known to be partially paralyzed and rarely left the house. Police drove out to 3109 Fifth Avenue, not expecting anything out of the ordinary. Older people often quite voluntarily chose not to venture outdoors for days at a time. What they found was beyond imagination. The whole wall and entryway steps were covered in blood, and the stench of death was overwhelming. Charles Garner was found in the kitchen. The horrendous damage to Garner seemed to indicate he had been singled out for a particularly vicious and agonizing death. Some major trauma appeared to have been caused by a baseball bat. Additional insult, though, was carried out with 5 knives, a fork, and scissors. The last 2 items had been left protruding from Garner's body. Pages from a telephone book had been dropped onto his back and ignited. Upstairs in Blanche Page's bedroom, yet another horrific scene was discovered. Every wall in that room was covered with blood. It was like a scene from a slasher movie, only much, much worse. In the bed lay Blanche Page, as if sleeping, except she had been bludgeoned to death with the baseball bat used against Garner. The killers had beaten her until she was dead. Then they had simply continued beating her corpse. They had continued until her head was mush and the body black from blood and contusions. It takes quite a bit of force to beat a body with a blunt object so hard that it ruptures. The Brileys did this and more. One thing I have not, dear listener, been able to ascertain is how the killers managed to leave the crime scene without anyone noticing them. They must have been absolutely covered in blood from head to toe. The brother seems to have the devil's luck during their killing career. After a reign of terror that had left a community paralyzed in fear, the endgame for the Briley brothers began on the 19th of October 1984. It wasn't a grand showdown or a climactic battle, but rather a series of small breaks in the case that eventually led the authorities to their door. A survivor of their brutal attacks, a woman who miraculously lived to tell the tale, gave a description of her assailants and their vehicle. This, coupled with a tip from a neighbor who had noticed the brothers' suspicious behavior, prompted the police to investigate. They found the Briley residence abandoned, but, crucially, discovered evidence linking the brothers to the string of gruesome murders. The net was closing in. Inexplicably, even though arrest warrants had been obtained, James and Anthony entered Richmond Police Headquarters and turned themselves in. All told, within 24 hours of locating and investigating the Wilkerson crime scene, police arrested Linwood and Duncan Meekins as well. One would think that once behind bars, the Briley gang would no longer pose a lethal threat to society. Well, dear listener, you would be wrong to think so. The 31st of May 1984 was the date of the infamous death row escape of the so-called Mecklenburg Six, the masterminds of which were Linwood and James Briley. The rest of the group were Lem D. Tuggle, 32, and convicted murderer Earl Clanton Jr., 29, strangler of a librarian Willie Leroy Jones, 26, convicted robbery and the murder of two senior citizens, Derek L. Peterson, 22, who had killed a grocery store employee. With 4.5 years of little else to do or think, Linwood and James were able to hatch a near-perfect plan. In truth, their plan was a success. Getting away with it, though, proved too much, even for two minds so cunning and surprisingly organized. In May 1984, there were 24 men jailed on death row, or Space E, its official designation. Of these, roughly 12 were aware of the brothers' crazy plan, and only 6 stuck it out to the bitter end. The escapees spent months monitoring conversations heard on an intercom. Makeshift knives were fashioned from available materials, inserted into wall cracks, and painted over during routine maintenance. Even though the inmates determined to break out had, when the day came, shaved and trimmed their hair in obvious preparation, not a single guard took notice of this very coincidental grooming. Sometime between 8 p.m. and 8:30, most of the inmates stepped from twilight and gathered before the threshold of C Pod, a section of death row. The guards did not make a head count nor notice when Earl Clanton Jr. lingered behind the other prisoners and snuck into the control booth's bathroom. The group filed into their cells, until a nurse tried to enter the bathroom to obtain water for dispensing various inmate medications. The locked door had gone unheeded. Frustrated, she complained. James Briley snapped into action, improvised a rationale. Hours ago, Briley said to the control room guards, he overheard someone say the plumbing wasn't working. Incredibly, they shrugged off the problem and sent the nurse to another water source. Whether Briley's next move was also on the fly isn't known. But around 9 p.m, he feigned wanting something to read. Books were kept in a day room beside the control room, and James politely requested the guard step out and get one. The control room door was opened, and Briley shouted a signal to Clanton, who rushed from the bathroom and overpowered the guard. There could be no turning back now. Hesitation meant violent death. Clanton took over the control panel and opened every cell. Chaos ruled, and in minutes the entire pod was under prisoner control. Guards, unarmed, had their uniforms taken, mouths silenced with tape, and hands restrained behind their backs. In a controlled burst of energy, the six outward-bound inmates tore through uniforms looking for those closest to their sizes. They had to be convincing to hostile eyes. One of the prisoners managed to overcome a lieutenant, and the plan moved on to the next stage. A ready knife against his throat, the official was forced to call for a van. Clad in helmets and gas masks from a purloined closet and bearing shields, the six dominated C-Pod. Still, no other guards or prisoners elsewhere in the facility were aware of the riotous events unfolding under the same roof. In order to get out of the facility, the Briley-led group had to make it out of Building 1, where stood the main control room. A female guard was on duty and received a staged message telling her there was an outside call. The lieutenant then informed her that someone was on the way to cover the room while she took her call. Unsecuring and opening the door, the guard could see whomever had been sent striding toward her post. Was this some new employee? Before she could fully react, inmate Derek L. Peterson, one of the six, overpowered her. Erupting from Building 1 and pushing a rattling gurney, the inmates shouted warnings that, under a blanket, was an unstable explosive device. Two of the helmeted men doused the bulky shape with repeated bursts from fire extinguishers, giving the effect of cooling some dangerous chemical reaction. Known only to them, the bomb was in fact a television, lifted from inside. Both darkness and disguise concealing their faces, the prisoners halted the gurney beside the van. Carefully lifting the bomb, they guided it into the van and gave abrupt orders to the guard. Open both doors. Some inexplicable mix, or perhaps poor training, and the bomb squad's urgent cries convinced the guard to open up. The van drove off into the vast blackness. The group's initial plan was to escape into Canada. Two inmates, Lem Davis Tuggle Jr. and Willie Leroy Jones, almost succeeded, making it as far as Vermont before being captured at gunpoint by police. The group was held at Marble Valley Correctional Facility in Rutland, pending their extradition back to Virginia. Splitting off from their two remaining co-escapers at Philadelphia, the Brileys went to live near their uncle, Johnny Lee Council, in the north of the city. They were captured on the 19th of June by a heavily armed group of FBI agents and police who had determined their location by placing wiretaps on their uncle's phone line. In short order, the remaining appeals ran out for both of the death row brothers. Several weeks before his execution, James Briley married a writer who believed his claims of innocence, Evangeline Grant Redding, on the 28th of March, 1985, in a prison ceremony attended by his father, James Sr. The brothers were executed in the electric chair at the Virginia State Penitentiary in Richmond, Linwood on the 12th of October, 1984, and James on the 18th of April, 1985. Linwood's last meal consisted of grilled tenderloin steak, a baked potato, green peas, a salad with French dressing, rolls with butter, cake, peaches, punch, and milk. His last words were, and I quote, "I am innocent," end quote. James' last meal consisted of fried shrimp with cocktail sauce and lemon-lime flavored soft drink. In his final moments, he smiled at the witnesses and twice asked them, and I quote, "Are you happy?" End quote. For my dear listeners, who might be new to the show, and to refresh the memory of my long-time listeners, here is a brief overview of what execution by electric chair entails. Seeking a more humane method of execution than hanging, New York built the first electric chair in 1888 and executed William Kemmler in 1890. Soon, other states adopted this execution method. Today, electrocution is not used as the sole method of execution in any state. Electrocution was the sole method in Nebraska until the state Supreme Court ruled the method unconstitutional in February 2008. For execution by the electric chair, the person is usually shaved and strapped to a chair with belts that cross his chest, groin, legs, and arms. A metal skullcap-shaped electrode is attached to the scalp and forehead over a sponge moistened with saline. The sponge must not be too wet, or the saline short-circuits the electric current, and not too dry, as it would have a very high resistance. An additional electrode is moistened with conductive jelly, electrocreme, and attached to a portion of the prisoner's leg that has been shaved to reduce resistance to electricity. The prisoner is then blindfolded. After the execution team has withdrawn to the observation room, the warden signals the executioner, who pulls a handle to connect the power supply. A jolt of between 500 and 2000 volts, which lasts for about 30 seconds, is given. The current surges and is then turned off, at which time the body is seen to relax. The doctors wait a few seconds for the body to cool down and then check to see if the prisoner's heart is still beating. If it is, another jolt is applied. This process continues until the prisoner is dead. The prisoner's hands often grip the chair, and there may be violent movement of the limbs, which can result in dislocation or fractures. The tissues swell. Defecation occurs. Steam or smoke rises, and there is a smell of burning. The prisoner's eyeballs sometimes pop out and rest on the cheeks. The prisoner often defecates, urinates, and vomits blood and drool. The body turns bright red as its temperature rises, and the prisoner's flesh swells, and his skin stretches to the point of breaking. Sometimes the prisoner catches fire. Witnesses hear a loud and sustained sound like bacon frying, and a sickly sweet smell of burning flesh permeates the chamber. At post-mortem, the body is hot enough to blister if touched, and the autopsy is delayed while the internal organs cool. There are third-degree burns with blackening where the electrodes met the skin of the scalp and legs. According to Robert H. Kirshner, the deputy chief medical examiner of Cook County, the brain appears cooked in most cases. In other words, execution by electric chair is very similar to being burned alive, and is probably one of the most painful ways to die imaginable.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Anthony Ray Briley was convicted of 4 counts of first-degree murder, 3 of those for the Barton family murders. He received a life sentence plus 119 years, with the possibility of parole. Anthony avoided capital murder charges, since it could not be proven that he had personally committed any of the murders. He is incarcerated at Augusta Correctional Center, about 20 miles, that's 30 kilometers, outside Staunton, Virginia. To date, all his applications for parole has been denied by the State Parole Board, as have those of Duncan Meekins, despite recommendations from former prosecutors Robert J. Rice and Warren von Schuch, who have cited Meekins' assistance in prosecuting and convicting the Briley brothers. And with that, we come to the end of the Slaying Brothers saga. Next episode, I'll bring you a fresh serial killer exposé. So, as they say in the land of radio, stay tuned.